Welcome to the School of Batman, a podcast where we ask academics to help Batman fight crime using their research. I'm your host, Chris George, amateur scientist and professional Batman enthusiast. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the case of the mysterious Alfred. We're pleased to be joined by Tom Scott Phillips. Tom's undergrad was in mathematics, and he has a PhD in human communication and evolution in linguistics from the University of Edinburgh, and did postdoctoral work in anthropology at Durham University. Tom is currently a senior researcher in the Department of Cognitive Science in the Social Mind Centre at the Central European University. So hi Tom, thank you for joining us. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, it's hot here in Budapest.
Great. So yeah, that's where the Central European University is, I'm guessing.
That's right, yes.
Great. So one of the things I think that is quite interesting about the life of the academic is how much people move around and what leads to that and why that works. So tell us a little bit about how you got to this particular university, and you've moved around a little bit from Edinburgh to Durham. Why does that kind of thing happen? And how did you end up where you are?
Moving around, physically moving around, happens because it's strongly encouraged in one's intellectual development to expose yourself to different departments. And it is true, I didn't really believe it actually when I was first told this in Edinburgh, that going to other departments widens your intellectual horizons. You just, you know, different scientists, different departments even, just approach problems, frame them in different ways. But it is true, when you move around, it is enriching, no question. I've moved around also between departments, but that's obviously a little bit distinctive to my own story. Many people are, you know, they're biologists and they move from one biology department to another, for example.
Yeah, so your journey of going from mathematics to human communication, to anthropology, to Department of Cognitive Science, is cognitive science kind of an umbrella for everything below that, or is that another discipline entirely?
Yes, it's an umbrella term. So the term comes from the 1950s and the 60s, and it is meant to be quite a catch-all term. So there's this thing called the cognitive science hexagon, which was first created, I guess, at that time. And the 6 points of the hexagon are, in theory, psychology, linguistics, artificial intelligence, neuroscience, philosophy, and anthropology. And the idea is to study minds and their interaction, how the mind works, how information flows through groups, and thus how societies and cultures get organized.
Right, so are you expected to be kind of, not an expert, but are you expected to be able to touch all of those 6 points?
Not really. So over time, cognitive science has become dominated by cognitive psychology in particular. And in my opinion, the integration between those different points of the hexagon has become a little bit lost. So cognitive science is sometimes used as a synonym for psychology or cognitive psychology. That's a pity. I'm comfortable with linguists and psychologists, philosophers, evolutionary biologists and anthropologists, but I'm also not a native of any of those disciplines. So it's quite an unusual situation. This makes, I think, it's exciting and it's interesting. It's not necessarily the most strategic choices, set of choices from a career point of view, but, you know, it's super interesting. So.
Could you define for me, just out of interest, what a society means to you and what culture means to you?
Society's harder and I haven't thought as much about that, but culture I can talk about, certainly. So over time I've come to think of culture as, and I'm following, I should make clear, what I'm about to say is not original with me. It's derived from a brilliant and very influential cognitive scientist, cognitive anthropologist called Dan Sperber. And in his work, and I'm sort of elaborating on this a bit at the moment, culture is not so much a thing, but a property. So traditional anthropological approaches, and also some more evolutionary approaches, tend to think of culture as a thing. So certain things in the world are culture. So, you know, my watch, it's a tool, and it's a cultural thing. That is an example of culture. So whether something is cultural is kind of a yes-no question. I think it's better to think of culture as a property. So just as an analogy, think of wetness. Some things are wet, But wet, they can be wet to different degrees. Some things are, you know, soaked through, and some things are bone dry, and there's lots of stages in between those two. And I think culture is similar. So some things are highly cultural, and some things are not cultural at all, or maybe just a little bit.
So let's talk about the work that you do and how that fits in with the department. So what is your day-to-day like? What are you studying? What questions are you looking to answer?
So day-to-day, I do a mix of reading, writing, talking, sometimes designing and running experiments. Increasingly, I've come over time to care a lot about integration between disciplines. And it's a bit of a surprise to me. It's something I've learned over the years that not as many scientists care about that as I would have expected when I started out. You know, how do the findings and the discoveries of linguists relate to those of psychologists? How do those of psychologists relate to those of evolutionary biologists and so on? Now, obviously, some people study these things, but it's surprising to me that the mainstream of those disciplines tend not, you know, they have their domains of expertise, their channels, and they do well in them, and they you know, do interesting work. I've come to care, as I say, a lot about the integration, so more and more I spend my time reading and writing, frankly. But sometimes I identify a particular question that I think is of key importance for those sorts of themes. So I do run some experiments, I work on a few models, mathematical models. So there's kind of a mix of different things, but as I say, increasingly I'm doing a lot of reading and writing.
Tell us about what an experiment might look like in your field.
So within our department, we're very strong on social cognition, hence the social minds theme. Social cognition experiments are sometimes done with adults, but I think some of the really interesting ones are done with infants, and you can also do comparable experiments with non-human species. So for instance, you might design a very similar experiment to run in infants and also in, say, chimpanzees. And similarities and differences can be very informative about the nature of human cognition, about species differences, and so on and so forth. So in these experiments, in such experiments, you might set up a situation where an infant or a child comes into a lab. And so in some cases, they might watch a video, and then you put an eye trackers on them or some other measure of what they think is going on when they're watching this video. And by comparing how different infants react to different videos, you can make inferences about what infants know or what they expect, and so on and so forth. Another way of doing something similar is to make it behavioral. So you get the infant or the child into a situation where there's a game or a puzzle or something, but you set the game or the puzzle up in slightly different ways for different children, and then by comparing how they behave in those situations, you can make inferences, like I say, about what they do and what they don't know, how they expect others to behave, whether they expect fairness, for example, you know, all sorts of questions you can ask in that way.
It's time to dive into your story now, Tom. Before we do our story, we like to ask our guests to choose an actor to represent their Batman. Have you chosen somebody to represent your Batman in your story?
I have. I wasn't sure myself which of the Batman actors to choose, so I put the question out on social media. I asked my Facebook friends, and there was a very strong majority opinion for Adam West.
Wow! that's great that you had such an overwhelming response for one particular person. So Adam West it is. Let's move on to your story. The distinctive smell of his favourite coffee awakens Bruce from a restless night of sleep. Alfred, his faithful butler, has followed this routine every day since he was a young man. Heading down to the Batcave, he finds Alfred waiting with the morning briefing. A few minutes into conversation, something is not quite right. The way he brushes over the recent spike in activity from Hugo Strange, the way he's standing, alarm bells ring. What on earth could be wrong? So we have a situation here, Tom. Hugo Strange, for people who are not aware, is a very clever villain in the Batman universe who has experience of building highly advanced robots. He's tricked Batman before with these, And there's been a lot of recent activity from Hugo Strange. So these alarm bells ringing off are making Batman think that Alfred is maybe not the Alfred that he knows and loves. So utilizing the expertise he's picked up from you in the past, these kind of slight tells and these kind of alarm bell ringing, we've got some kind of very advanced Turing test on our hands. So let's talk a little bit about some of your work in human communication, evolution, linguistics, and really the fundamental question of what it means to be human and how humans interact. So it's a lot of questions there, so it's up to you where you want to start, but let's start somewhere.
Humans are profoundly social creatures. I don't think that's a particularly surprising point, but it's the pivotal importance of that is not always appreciated. We live in sizable groups, and these groups have this quality of being somewhat cooperative and somewhat competitive. And humans have evolved a mind that is extremely finely tuned to picking up all sorts of indications about what people might be aiming to do, what they want, what they desire, what they might think about you, and so on and so forth. And we care enormously about these things, because if we have a poor reputation, we won't be surviving for very long in human groups, given how interdependent and social we are. So this stuff is everywhere in human life. I'll pick up on a little example that's quite famous in anthropology in particular. So there's a famous essay by an anthropologist called Clifford Geertz, where he picks up from a philosopher this idea of what a wink is. And kind of a simple answer to that question is it's a twitch of the eyelid. But it's not really just a twitch of the eyelid, right? A wink is normally communicative, often covert. It has some sort of social function, social meaning, which is a little bit ambiguous, highly context dependent, and so on and so forth. But then when you start to think about it a bit more, you realize even those characterizations aren't quite right. There are all sorts of winks in the world that don't quite fit that description. And so in the end, what you come to realize, and what Clifford Geertz points out in this essay, is that knowing what a wink is a, you know, just something as simple, supposedly simple as a wink, is actually, you know, to know what that is marks you out as very socially sophisticated, as picking up on all sorts of nuances about what people are trying to do in any given context. And just observing people, you're always interpreting what they're doing, they're interpreting what you're doing, and so on and so on. Which is why, you know, just describing human affairs is hard. Describing it in terms that are amenable to, you know, scientific description and so on. It's a hard business. But as just individual agents in the world, we're surprisingly good. We know the difference between a wink, a real wink, and a fake wink, or just an involuntary twitch of the eyelid. We can pick up on that, even though its function and its exact manifestation might vary enormously from one wink to another.
So the question of what makes us human seems like the most difficult question probably of our time, really. So how do you find such a difficult question? Is that overwhelming, or is that exciting? Do you anticipate coming up with any answers in your lifetime? That I can't grasp what it'd be like to work on such a difficult question.
First thing I should say is it's certainly, you know, while it's difficult, there's lots of scientific questions which are really difficult, and I don't want to downplay the difficulty of all sorts of other questions that I would be hopeless at thinking about, frankly. But it's a super interesting question, and that's why I do it. Maybe it's useful, it's worthwhile me zooming out a bit here. So I'm talking about why I became an academic in the first place. As you mentioned earlier, I did my undergraduate degree in mathematics. And after that, I did some different jobs in my mid-20s. I was trying things out. It was quite a common experience, I think. And it was during that time that I started to read some of the work of some well-known figures in the areas that I now work in. So particularly famous examples would be Richard Dawkins and Steven Pinker. But there are others too, Helena Cronin, Daniel Dennett. And I mean, now I'm more expert. I have informed disagreements with all those writers. But back then, what I was picking up in my mid-20s, what is it's possible to think about these questions, you know, what am I doing here? What is going on around me? why are we here? It's possible to think about those questions with the tools of natural science, and that excited me. So that's why I went into to do a PhD in these sorts of areas. Will I come up with, I mean, there's no definitive answer to these questions, but my own understanding has advanced, as you would hope, I guess. My own understanding has advanced over the years, and I just hope that I will be able to communicate that both to, you know, academics and also to the wider public as time goes by.
I want to go back to something that we said earlier on to start us down a path of discussion. We were talking about humans being profoundly social animals. What does that mean in this context? What does being a social animal mean? Is there a kind of reward? If it's taken away, is there negative effects? What does that mean?
From a purely biological point of view, a social animal is one that lives in groups. I mean, that's a kind of a minimal definition, if you like. The point about humans is not simply that we live in groups, but we live in groups that we kind of mix and match. People come and go. There's different levels of what the group is at different times for different, you know, purposes. And as I said, there's not just competition, but also a lot of cooperation, and cooperation not just with your kin, with those that you share genes, but with non-kin as well, to quite a high degree sometimes. So there's all this sort of crisscrossing of motivations and interests and so on, and that has created over evolutionary time a mind that is not just, you know, social in the sense that many animal minds are social, but social in a, I guess, a more deeper or more profound sense that I was getting at earlier, of picking up on very subtle cues of motivation and so on and so forth. Some of those things, no doubt, some aspects of such minds exist in other species, and particularly our primate relatives. But there are some aspects of it that I think are distinctly human, and in a way, you know, the big one for me is communication. And we communicate in a quite distinctive way that's, you know, picks up on these sorts of subtleties and kind of expands them into, ends up creating this way of information flowing between individuals and through groups that has, you know, massive runaway effects in the way that human societies are organized.
Excuse me, a brief aside. I was reading about Blockbuster today and the last Blockbuster in the US and talking about, I was reading an interview with a manager who's talking about the impact on the community of having this Blockbuster, as he sees a lot of evidence of people who are kind of sick of just interacting with computers to get their media, and they like the social aspect of coming into that Blockbuster. And I think if you agree with the premise that certainly Western society seems to be moving towards, from a technological perspective, avoiding direct human interaction. So with things like Uber, self-service checkouts, a lot of technical advances seem to be about removing humans from typical human-to-human interactions. So I guess my question A is, why do you think that's happening? And B, just purely anecdotally, I feel like there's an inevitable negative effect from that, but I can't pinpoint why I feel that way. So if you agree with that, why do you think that is?
The first one, I mean, the very short answer is this. It's a consequence of neoliberal capitalism. Bottom line is, a lot of these services are cheaper to run, and people are willing to accept that sort of service at that particular price, and that's why they, you know, they become more and more common. I totally see the point that the Blockbuster manager is saying about, you know, there's a sense of community and there's a sort of a human aspect to some things that are vanishing in the light of those technological developments. Is it a bad thing? Well, I mean, one part of me is minded to agree with you, but there's another part of me that is always suspicious of it was better in the good old days kind of thinking. I do think humans are very prone to thinking things were better at some other imagined time. And that's not to say that things are always better, that's clearly not true. But equally, I don't think we should listen to those intuitions without checking three times whether, you know, that's actually true. And so, yeah, maybe we are losing something. I know, I think that, I guess I feel that the the way to react to such things is not to try and push back against that change, but to find new ways of satisfying the desires, the things that have been lost.
Yeah. So I mean, sticking on the human-robot interaction theme, I think that's probably something that's going to be very much more prevalent over the next decade as time goes on. How do you feel like human-robot interactions could be improved if they were going to be directly communicating? Do you feel like it's something that people should look towards designing increasingly more human robots, or is there another approach which might avoid any kind of cognitive dissonance of things being close but not quite close enough?
It seems to me that artificial intelligence, at least some parts of it, was originally conceived as developing minds and intelligences that are similar, not just in competence, but in nature, to human minds and human intelligences. And over time, that's not to say that some people in artificial intelligence aren't still pursuing that goal, but over time, more and more, it seems to me, it's not exactly my area, but still, it seems to me that a lot of the advances they're advances in competencies, but they're not doing it in the same way that human minds do it. So, you know, just to take the obvious example, AI systems are extremely good at playing chess now, far better than humans. They don't try and play chess the way humans do. They don't pretend that they're trying to play chess the way that humans do. And then to take it into the world of interaction, so the sort of chatbots and things and other services that are automating, some sort of interaction, they're not trying to process sentences the way that humans process sentences. Or at least it doesn't seem to me that that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to achieve the same competence, but they do it in a different way that takes advantage of the features that computers have at the present time. I don't think they're trying to do it in the way humans are doing it, and if they are trying to do it, they're failing, because the fundamental key thing about human minds is how social they are, and where abilities to communicate and to reason and all sorts of other things grow out of that social nature of human minds.
What's been one of the most surprising things you've discovered about any aspect really around humans in your work since you've started? Something maybe that seems counterintuitive or something you didn't expect?
So I don't know if surprising is the right word, but certainly what's very intriguing to me is the competence that young infants have at a lot of these social abilities. And I'm thinking in particular about communication, which is my real area of expertise. So just to take an example of some work that came out of this department quite recently, infants can see two agents interacting with one another. That interaction can just consist of sort of garbled sounds. They're not linguistic or anything like that. They're not recognizably anything. If the context is, sufficiently transparent, so it's plausible that this agent is trying to do that, and it's plausible that agent knows what the other one is trying to do and what it doesn't know about something and so on. Infants can track all that, and they will just presume that what one agent is doing when it makes these garbled noises is relevant for the other agent. So they're very, even at, so we're talking 9 to 12 months here, which is amazing, really.
So that's it for today's episode. Batman, using his finely tuned sense of empathy and communication, can decipher that the Alfred is not the Alfred he knows and loves, get to Hugo Strange's and rescue him and save the day. Thanks to Tom for joining us.
Not a problem, it's a pleasure to be here.
And if you'd like to find out more about Tom and his work, you can find him on Twitter at @tscottphillips. That link will also be in the description of the episode. If you'd like to be a future guest on the podcast, please email us at info@figshare.com. And you can find us on Twitter at School of Batman.